Okay.
Thank you for the opportunity. My name is Damir. I work at SIPRI, Stockholm Peace Research Institute, and I'm development economist looking at impact evaluation methods. So my question to all of you relates to timing. When do we measure the effectiveness as well as presence of other donors in areas we do provide development aid? So as a researcher, we always complain that timing was not enough to measure the impact. So the development aid is usually connected to budget cycles, so say 3 to 4 to 5 years. So in a way, do you think there is any thoughts, any developments that allow us to measure the effectiveness after we leave the area where aid was provided? And secondly, about presence of other donors. So in our project, we evaluate in Kyrgyzstan in over 100 villages. When we collected baseline data, in over 80% of them already got some other projects going on. So practically, despite of having control and treatment communities, despite of measuring any time, it's really contaminated situation. So we are measuring anything. So meaning, is it that a donor should really invest in one sector and keep doing and learning over time? From what Craig described, the situation with DFID, it looks like we compete for hot topics and it's increasingly probably different over time. So anyway, these two items, two aspects, timing and presence of others when we measure our effectiveness. Thank you.
Okay, who's going to address this challenging question?
Maybe I can try to, but it's perhaps a trivial answer that, of course, you need evaluations. You need process evaluations and you need ex post evaluation. And depending on the purpose and depending on what you were to use it for. This is something that is also discussed within the EBA that has a role to look at the effects of Swedish development cooperation. So definitely I would say one cannot exclude the other. And also when it comes to the presence of other donors, yes, that is a problem, but I suppose we live in the world we live in, and then you come into the whole broader question of harmonization and of aid, which is unfortunately in many countries going in the wrong direction. And that's of course not only a problem for impact evaluation and picking up what was the, which is perhaps not the most important question, what was the exact impact of the Swedish money? But it has much broader consequences when it becomes too fragmented. And in the end, it's a fact, those are often political decisions from a lot of different countries that contribute to many players often being in the same areas.
I'm going to have a quick shot at that as well. I wasn't sure if I was going to because it's such a difficult question that I'm liable to mess it up. but I'll give it a go. The first challenge, I think, is that we still are constantly thinking that the only way to find out whether a program is doing any good or not is to do an RCT. And I think that's not the only way. I think there are also real... So the first point is there has to be mixed methods. I'm not, by the way, labeling that yourself or your research institute, but just generally we have to be able to employ mixed methods that draw on different kinds of ways of thinking about a specific kind of outcome or problem that we're looking at. And if we don't do that, then we will always have relatively narrow results that get skewed. And I think it's even more difficult when we start talking about things like adaptive programs where things you're controlling for start changing. So then you're not doing the same intervention through the life of a program. So then that gets really messy. So I think you end up having to use process evaluation or developmental evaluation and start actually putting some resources into that in a serious way so that you have that more kind of critical friend evaluator and you have someone who comes and does one after. But we're still locked into a fairly linear mindset that presumes that we can control for things like this, I think, for these places that are going to change and interventions that are going to change. So we have to get research methods that are sensible enough to tackle that challenge. Otherwise, we're always going to have this tension.
Okie doke. Question here.
Thank you. I'm Stefan Dahlgren, what's called independent consultant. I'm a bit surprised about the general satisfaction with ownership and that everything is good from the recipient points of view. I think this is, and has been for a long time, as you know, extremely donor-centered. Everything we've talked about today is about what donors are doing and how donors are framing the results agenda and so on. I wonder if you could say something about what do you see in the current development of, say, recipient-driven results-based management and results reporting. How do you see that you really, from, say, the donor's point of view, or how the donor can change its way of their way of ways of working to fit more into the recipient's needs, not only that we usually require from CEDA, for instance, that the results are reporting to CEDA through their ways of say delivering reports. There is a risk here, as I see it, that from the donor's point of view, we see it on the systems level, kind of general level and aggregate level. While if you stick to this way of looking at the recipient's point of view, it becomes a very much project-oriented. It becomes kind of divided into to small spaces instead of this overall agenda. So, what do you see in the present development about adopting more and more to the recipient's point of view and ways of working and the impact on the recipient's handling of aid? Thank you.
Rebecca?
Well, firstly, I just want to say that if we or I have given in the impression that everything is nice and dandy as relates to RBM or ownership, I just want to clarify, no, I don't believe it's nice and dandy, absolutely not. But we do what we can, I want to say. And one thing we can do that we have learned is that since CEDA has not been clear enough on what we do require and on what we do not require, I think there have been a lot of misunderstandings. Many cooperation partners have indeed believed that they need to sort of fit everything into matrices and report on quantitative sort of indicators and so on. And I think just us starting to emphasize that what's main importance for us is that they do apply results-based management as an approach for learning and adaptation for their own sake. And we have also explicitly stated, you can see it on CEDA's website, we're going to talk about it a lot tomorrow, what is not required and so on. That's the sort of the first sort of, how shall I say, step we can take. But, I mean, there are indeed lots of misunderstandings. I remember once when I was in a dialogue as advisor with CEDA desk officer, cooperation partner, and it was completely stuck. And when I started to explain what we think, I mean, I've said several times already today what our view on results-based management is. And the civil society organization said, but of course we're doing that for our own sake, but that's not what you at CEDA want, is it? So, you know, I think it's also about us sort of showing that it's okay what many of you already are doing, because sometimes it's almost like we are playing a game, I think. So.
Okay. Okay. No, not first, not you. Okay.
And just in addition to what you said, it's, first of all, it's always becomes a bit strange talking about ownership and partner initiatives and so on when we don't have any of the partners in the room. So actually, one would like to pose the question in the country itself. I just, in addition to what you said, I would like to just point at two broader trends in the content on development cooperation. And we see from the perspective of the ministry, there's a 2030 agenda with all this, with the sustainable development goals, and there is a tremendous amount of work going on now in many countries on how to translate this into reality. So I think that this is one entry point. Another part, which is the fact that unfortunately, more and more of Swedish development cooperation goes into countries what we call weak countries, conflict countries, where often there this dream relation with a partner, it's sometimes not there. So those are just, I just want to point at that as factors that also influence how we work with ownership.
Okay, please.
Yeah, thanks very much for the question. I guess it speaks a lot to what we were actually trying to do, or at least what I was trying to do with the paper, which is to say that we wanted to look at the way in which the political agendas that were driving aid foreclose certain options, in this case ownership and participation. So I think a lot of the RBA and the broader sort of direction I see aid going towards projectised aid within the UK are very difficult to square with ownership and participation. So where I see it going is in the same direction until we politically manage to redefine the paradigm so that you can have a more ownership-driven aid model again. At the moment, ownership, I see it as, and participation more or less as a fig leaf for legitimising project, basically projectised aid that's technically driven. But then the previous ownership model wasn't that much better either. I mean, it was better, but it was still very technocratic, driven by high-level government negotiations, a Paris Declaration. There was a laundry list of this health and reform, this education reform, and then you get budget support. So I wonder how, and participation got hollowed out when that was tried as well. So I wonder, you know, So it's very difficult to overcome the fact that basically the donors have the money and therefore the power. And they're driven politically by political Janet. Domestic politics in the UK.
No, also, and this is also Rebecca's comment earlier on this, my solidarity and effectiveness rationale. I think it's somehow... It could be talked about the solidarity and the ownership and like partners and that's on the political agenda today. But I think what it becomes kind of, and that's really also like the tension is that typically these types of like results measurement initiatives, they become something else than they were initially aimed at to be in, like recipients owned and all that, which is could be in the language of results-based management as well. But then it's also now we're kind of talking very positively about all of this new agenda of adaptive management and trust-based and trusting relationships, and so. But it's also, of course, that has a cost as well. It's really something, I think, within this trust-based commission, Susanna is part, it's a lot of discussion that, of course, that's an alternative and it's an option, but of course it costs a lot to know exactly what each recipient wants and knows and have that personal relationship for it. So you do need an administrative system. You need a control apparatus in a bureaucracy. You can't be in a personal relation exactly with everyone and have a personal trusting relation. So somehow just be aware so that we actually do have a balance between them. You would need some type of controlling apparatus, but you would also need to be very keen on having a trusting relation with the recipient. So, yeah. So we don't like fall down to the other side again. But, yeah.
It's a little tangential, but it might be worth mentioning just to give a bit more detail to the British experience relating to what you just mentioned. Right now, it's not that, for example, DFID have gone full doing development differently and that's what they're doing. In fact, they're doing it at the same time as having all the existing results and compliance reporting that was required before. So what you actually see is not that there's kind of a trade-off and there you have one... You know, you have to, that cost takes some time, money, resources, and then, okay, you can't do the other one so much. Actually, people who care about doing development differently and things like that are doing it on top of their day jobs, right? Which is, I suspect, is what a lot of them were doing anyway, but now there's a language for it, right? And I just think it's worth saying that because in the UK, as much as ODI, among others, has contributed to kind of publicising where DFID has started to try and work in different ways. Proportionally, in the whole of DFID, this is not a huge number of projects that are working differently. There's a lot of language, but not necessarily a lot of action. So you're aware of that, worth flagging.
Okay, reading your reports and listening to you guys, it seems that you all sort of agree that the results agenda in some form is going to continue to be around. The question is what aspects we are thinking about here. the last set of reforms in Sweden and in the UK, I think, was introduced by sort of conservative liberal governments with a sort of skeptical attitude to aid, and they were much concerned about the accountability dimension, I would say, in Sweden, that you want to report that this is something is done anyway, in some sense. So accountability is one aspect that you can report on. And then you have all this issue about learning as such. You want to understand what's going on, and to be able to understand what's going on, you need to understand what the outcomes are in various ways. And that can be done in various different fashions. But then we have this management technique then with a very strict goal. So it's like a third dimension. Apart from accountability learning, there's also the use of precise measurements to steer what people are doing, or to give them goals to work against. So typically, from a sort of management perspective, I think this was introduced as a way, okay, you set up a goal for somebody, and then they can do whichever way they want to get to the goal. But if we give that up, we don't want to set these goals in this way anymore, we want to do something else. We go back to rule-based systems then, the regulation saying this is the way you do it, or where does this take us? I mean, the learning story is going to be there, and the accountability story is going to be there, but the interesting thing is what the management setup is going to be, I think. And since there are lots and lots of donors around the world doing things, and I guess some of them do things differently, so is there anybody doing anything sensible that you would like to copy? DFID, you don't want to copy anymore, I understand, maybe. Although I always thought that DFID was a sensible guy. But is there, on some scale, some new technique, or what is the right balance here between goal setting, steering, and leaving it up to the operators? I mean, where are you going? Everybody can't be running in the wrong direction, and somebody must be doing something right somewhere, is my hypothesis. So,
what I think was very good, what Janet pointed out in her dissertation, is that CEDA is not a homogeneous organization, and neither there is DFID. I just must say that I've seen lovely things being funded by DFID. There are really great programs there. And I believe that there are some funded by CEDA as well and by many other donors. So when we talk about complexity, there are complexity within the donor organizations as well. So I think instead of thinking in terms of, okay, who is the good guy now or who is the bad guy, we should sort of look at, okay, what are sort of the inspiring examples and what could be tried out here? Because I think, and what are the factors, as you're actually going to look into, Janet, what are the factors that hinder people to do things in a meaningful way, and what are the factors that actually encourage people to do so? My personal sort of belief is that it has a lot to do with psychology, organizational psychology, but also personal psychology. Because as I said before, if you are to learn, you have to admit that maybe something, you know, this fancy thing we love to say nowadays, to celebrate failure. I mean, who does that in reality? But you have to be fairly senior and feel trust. And also, I heard, I think it was ODI seminar I attended some weeks ago, where somebody said that RBM is about, it's an attitude of being curious. I think that was great. So I think we could explore that more, those factors, instead of looking at whomever to copy and in what direction we should all go, because I think that will fail.
Maybe I can give you all the chance to give a final quick comment on what we've learned and where we should go. So,
it got me first, damn. Okay, maybe just a few reflections of a couple of points that came up that I didn't quite get the chance to chip in on. I mean, one is it relates to a few different things about the paradigm shift and how much things have shifted, but also about how development is slow to pick these things up. So new public management, kind of what you're describing, where we have to have some sort of target and goal and all these things, that's a huge part of new public management thinking, right? And in around 2007-08 in the UK, in the wider government, this was not as popular as it used to be. It came in primarily with New Labour in 97, and by it got to 2008, a lot of sectors, for example, the National Health Service, people were starting to wonder whether having, you know, a target of 8 minutes to reach someone when they're sick is a particularly good idea because it can lead to dodgy incentives. And a lot of those debates were happening. It just so happens that's precisely when DFID took it on board. Like, you know, and it's a really interesting thing about how development starts to lag like that. And so in the work we're doing on adaptive management right now, it's true, we're introducing language around agile and the like because business has been talking about that for ages, so now maybe we'll start talking about it for a little bit. So there's definitely something about there being a paradigm shift and about development being a bit behind the others. And I think one of the challenges is it kind of tends to swallow these things down and then kind of regurgitate them over and over, and we lose the essence of some of these ideas, right? So there's some sensible things in new public management. There's some sensible things in adaptive management. The problem is that we chew through them so fast in development that we forget the good bits.
Okay, Janet?
Yeah, no, I think something in the line, as you said also, we kind of, for me, all these waves, and it's like, yeah, development aid is blowing in with winds, and then we change clothes, and we change them really quickly. So just kind of to be stable and not look for copying and what is the newest fashion at this moment, but really like, okay, what can I still wear, and where do I actually, well, it's worn out, okay, then I add that. And so it's kind of just building up that type of stability and balance in that stability, because I don't think adaptive management or trust-based management or any of the, but neither result, there's not one and only answer to all the questions we are discussing. There needs to be a balance and somehow find that stability in that.
Okay. Yeah. Leonard?
Well, I think it's easy to agree with that. And, of course, I mean, I think what we've seen is that there has been a results agenda for the whole time. It's just that the content of this results agenda has shifted. I mean, when there was this big drive, when was that, just after 2000, World Bank report, Voices of the Poor, etc., there was also sort of a results initiative, but it was framed in a completely different ways. And when you're framing it, and yes, there are different fashions and so on, but I do really think that we are learning, and hopefully we are remembering something as well, the institutional memory, as you were talking about. And yes, continue to do so.
Brandon?
Yeah, I guess my point would be that RBM is basically a product of a particular political view to development in the UK and elsewhere, and that if you want to change it, then you need to be working politically in the UK to change the way that you look at development. And I think, as an addendum to that, more broadly, you need to look at the way that UK engages with the rest of the world, and that's part of a broader political discussion that's very live in the UK at the moment. And development, viewing development narrowly, is maybe not the best way to go anymore.
All right, thanks a lot. I'm getting close to the end. So this... sorry. But you started, did you?
Yeah, you could see that.
Yeah, you started. Okay. She did like this. Okay, we're finishing off this. I admit I'm an economist, so I still think that efficiency is a good thing. Results are important. And I'm a bit problematic with this solidarity, efficiency, dichotomy, conflict. I think it is important, and I think the rationale for EBA is to see that aid money is sensibly used to improve results in some sense. The question is how we do it, and we had a wide range of ideas as to where we take this discussion. And I think it's going to continue with Rebecca tomorrow at CIDA for a full day of interesting discussions. I was just, before we conclude and go home, say that there's going to be a new EBA seminar next week, 21st, actually at CIDA, 9 to 10:30, in Swedish maybe. Livslängd och livskraft, vad säger utvärderingar av svenska biståndsinsatsers hållbarhet? Then you can learn about, in Swedish, how sustainable Swedish projects are in the longer term. And that is also quite an important aspect of efficiency, whether projects survive once the donor's gone home. So this is an interesting seminar you should go to as well. So I thank the participants as well for a lively, interesting discussion. I think we give them a round of applause.